This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Arise, Sajourie, the incredible achievement of getting sent off in a friendly, making a meaningless game even more meaningless. Unless, of course, it meant something. Jude Bellingham stakes his place. Is Raheem Sterling still key? Some people boo Harry Maguire because, well, people. Meanwhile, we may revisit whether it's right for England fans to want England to win. Also, Portugal and Poland make it through to the finals, as do Senegal, as Mo Salah is laser penned into penalty submission. Cameroon make it through with the final kick and Ghana get past Nigeria. Paul Watson's here for the Oceania special, and we'll chat to Will Unwin, who's interviewed the chief executive of Shakhtar Donetsk about how the club is coping during the Russian invasion. Also, there's the extraordinary club statement from Staines Town, some spectacular Doncaster Rovers highlights, your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
I'm super, thanks. Johnny Lou, hello.
Hi, Max. How you doing?
Marvellous. And specifically for Oceania, but you may contribute to other parts of the pod if you so desire. Paul Watson, hi, mate.
Hi, mate.
Let's start then with England's win over the Ivory Coast. Johnny, what did we learn from this football match?
I learned that it's really hard to follow 12 football games at once, because I kept flicking from channel to channel, and you know, it was one of those, there was too much football, and you try and follow it all, and you end up following. So I can speak with great authority about sort of minutes 35 to 42, and then again from sort of 50 to 50. No, I thought we learned that Jude Bellingham has it. We learned that Ollie Watkins is very definitely the number three choice up front. And, you know, we learned that, I guess, England are all right, aren't they? Bellingham, I think, was the key takeaway there. There has, I think, been... There's been a rush to anoint him as the kind of the midfield general for the next 10 years. And I think there were calls to shove him in at the Euros, which were a little bit premature, I think. But he's done so much maturing this season at Dortmund. And he is a much better player than he was a year ago. And, you know, sometimes you can kind of overthink and overcomplicate these things. He is the nuts, put him in.
Is it too dangerous, Paul, to say he has everything?
It's always too dangerous to say that, especially on a pod like this where you'll get called up on that repeatedly. No, I mean, I think, you know, he may have everything and I don't wish to be quoted on that. But I'd take him.
He is the most complete midfielder in the world. Like, I can't think anyone else who has his skill set. Defending, attacking, set pieces. You know, he's good in the air. He can beat a man. He can win the ball. But, like, there's actually not many midfielders in the world who can do all that.
Yeah, he's remarkably accomplished. And considering he's only 18, he seems to have been around for an awful long time. He'll certainly be in the squad if he's fit. There will be a clamour for him to be in the team. You can only pick 11 players. A lot of very good players are not only going to be left out of the England starting lineup in Qatar, but out of the squad. And people will get upset whether it's club allegiances or not. But the fact of the matter is, you can only bring... Will we be going back to 23-man squads or... Will it be 26?
I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, but whatever it is, England are in the very enviable position. I say this as a Republic of Ireland fan, that they will leave an awful lot of players at home who would be automatic first choice selections for a lot of other teams.
Back to 23 players. I don't know, Paul, if it's... I mean, either we can speculate on who's going to start in that first game in Qatar, but it feels like there's so much football to be played because we've not only got the end of this season, we've got, you know, the first few months of next season and who'll be injured and who won't. But my takeaway was just the second half was just like one of the most painful footballing experiences I've had for sudden. Nothing happened.
See, I wanted to bring this up and I don't know. I've only watched the game as with Jonathan. I was scanning between five other games at the same time. But is it true that Jack Grealish was trying to convince the referee not to send Aurier off?
Yes,
because that's what people seem to be saying.
he looked a bit pissed off over it and said something to the ref, and the ref was not for turning.
He was speaking for all of us, really, wasn't he? I mean, I get the... There have even been some people, I think, saying, I saw on some tweets saying, should referees be sending players off in friendlies like this? Should they give a chance to take him off, like you do at schoolboy level, you know? Mm. If a player's being a bit of a knob, you talk to the captain, you get him off, and you carry on with 11. And I don't agree with that. I think, you know, you have to play it as if it's a real game of football, and there's a chance that England will have gained something, and there's a chance that in Qatar, England will play against a 10-man team, and maybe they'll have learned some how to prepare for that. But yeah, in terms of last night, it was, if Grealish was trying to say don't send him off, it was speaking for all of us, because it was game over at that point, wasn't it? They may as well have called time on it there, really.
I actually someone sent me something called, I think it's Seordle. It's the latest. It's 16 Wordles at once. And I was like, well, I'm going to give this a go during this second half. Well, England were just... I mean, England were zipping it about reasonably nicely. I mean, I actually thought, Johnny, that Sejourie was slightly unlucky with his second yellow card. I wasn't surprised he was sent off, because I've watched Sejourie play football. But I thought there were other challenges that weren't punished that could have got yellows, and he was a little bit unlucky.
I still couldn't tell you what the second yellow was for. Was it for dissent?
I think it was for dissent.
Yeah.
Because there were no replays. It was, you know, we were all Chris Kamara in that situation. Like, is it, you know, the interesting thing was, you know, Cote d'Ivoire certainly they didn't treat it like a friendly. I mean, a lot of the tackles flying in early on were quite spicy. And I don't know, like, as a referee, when one team is so clearly taking it more seriously than the other, it's a hard thing to judge. But you know, I would veer on the side of, as long as teams aren't getting, you know, silly about it and taking a few liberties, you want to try and keep as many players on the pitch as possible. This is not, it's not a big game. It's not a game with anything riding on it. You know, the fans have paid good money to see like a proper contest, and that's not really what they got, unfortunately.
Rich Jolly's tweet, Sejourie, the only player to be sent off at all of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the London Stadium and Wembley. So quite an achievement. Barry, what did you make of Harry Maguire being booed? Gareth Southgate wasn't happy about it. He said, I thought the reception was a joke, an absolute joke. The way he's performed for us has been absolutely phenomenal. I don't get it. We're either all in this together or we're not.
Well, I think fans are entitled to boo whoever they want, if they want. I don't get the booing of Harry Maguire, because while he's having a sticky patch, to say the least, for Manchester United, he's never really done much wrong in an England shirt. Maybe it was a pocket of Manchester United fans who don't get the opportunity to go to Old Trafford to boo him, availing of, you know, this sort of second-hand opportunity. It seems to be a peculiarly English thing. I mean, it's happened before with Raheem Sterling, Peter Crouch of all people, Frank Lampard. They've all been booed by England fans at one time or another. I personally don't get it. I would like, if I'd been sitting near someone who was booing Harry Maguire, I'd be curious to ask them, why are you doing this? Please explain it to me. And I don't think they'd be able to offer a very decent explanation. But Harry's a big boy. I'm sure he'll get over it.
I mean, probably because the person next to them was booing Harry Maguire. It's sort of my sense of these things. It's just a noise you can make at football that you can't really make in many other places. And, you know, it is quite fun to boo, but like, it's a funny noise to make when you sort of really analyze what you're doing. That's a really bizarre thing to be doing. But I would normally save it for the opposition to try and put them off rather than for Harry Maguire. A bit of fallout from Barney wondering why I want England to win a tournament from Monday's pod. Sam says, can we make a little bit more of the fact that Barney was confused that an English fan wanted England to win the Euros? Johnny says, any update on whether we should want, as England fans, for England to win the World Cup? Are this team eligible as good enough? And were our fans sufferable enough for us to want us to win? I need to know before wasting my time cheering us on. I mean, one correspondent, I believe, unsubscribed from listening to Football Weekly because they were so aghast at Barney suggesting it was odd. And I wonder if I should have been, Barry, if I should have been more forcefully, sportingly patriotic when I was questioned about it.
Yeah, I didn't really get that particular Barney point. And while, you know, I don't... sometimes when Barney starts talking, I tune out and don't really listen to what he's saying. And while it doesn't mean I disagree with him necessarily, even if I did disagree with him, it doesn't mean I would never come on the podcast again, because I appreciate that sometimes people are going to have different opinions to me. I certainly don't want England to win any tournaments, but I'm not English. So I do appreciate that you might want to be, as an Englishman, you might want the football team that represents your country to do well.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, I'm the opposite with Barney. When I listen too carefully and I really want to impress him. So then I was worried that maybe I was just sort of being subservient and not sticking up for myself. I wonder, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how sort of feverishly you, Paul, want England, or Johnny, you want England to win a major tournament.
I mean, I've come out of a very strange period. I was obviously a very passionate England fan growing up, and then we hit a generation where self-loathing kicked in. And I think a lot of English fans really didn't like the England players, didn't feel a connection to the team, but also didn't like the press and the way they handled it, didn't like some of the elements of what, you know, England fans get up to, still don't like that. And so it's been weird. I've spent a lot of my life really disliking England, but supporting England. And now suddenly we find ourselves with probably the most likable England team I ever remember. Well, definitely the most likable England team I ever remember since I loved them at Italia 90, which was my first taste of tournament football. And yeah, we've got this team of players that I respect, like, admire. And we still have fan elements that I don't like, but we also probably have, well, we definitely have the best team in my lifetime and probably the best chance of winning a World Cup. So it seems very English to then take that and say, well, we shouldn't be supporting them. You know, it doesn't make any sense, I think. But I do understand it's a hard transformation to make, because I've been sort of ashamed to support England for years, and now there's actually no reason really to be ashamed of it.
I love this team, and I haven't loved an England football team for a while. And yet I still kind of understand, I still understand that slight unease. And, you know, maybe it is just a Guardian thing. And can I just say, this is the most Guardian conversation ever. But also, I remember, you know, seeing at the Euro final last summer, seeing all the trouble outside and seeing how, you know, utterly wild and feral and unhinged the country became, and thinking, actually, the worst thing that, you know, that could happen would be for England to win this. It would be absolutely horrific. And also still wanting them to win the football match on the pitch. So, you know, being conflicted in that way, I understand. I actively want England to win at cricket, and I want England to win at football, and I actively want them to lose at rugby union. It's a slightly complicated thing, you know. But I'm in no position, and nobody's in any position to tell somebody else how they should feel about something, let alone something as complex and large as a country or a football team. Let people have nice things, or in Barney's case, let people repudiate nice things as well.
I wonder, with the Irish, and it is different because you don't qualify that often, we sort of get the sense that there wouldn't be that sense in Ireland. There wouldn't be a set of people questioning whether they should support this team or not if this was, you know, second captains or something. Or maybe they would, I don't know.
No, I don't think they would, but, you know, there are elements. Irish football fans are great at patting themselves on the back and telling everyone how great they are and how loved they are. But the last, what was it, Euro 2016, there were a few videos emerged of Irish fans doing things I wasn't necessarily impressed with. They weren't up there with, you know, England fans razing a city square to the ground or anything like that. But there are elements of all fan bases that are a bit unsavoury. England seem to have more than most. But there are, and if Ireland did well, there would be people who would be happy that I would be unhappy they're happy, but it doesn't stop me wanting Ireland to do well.
And you're right, you know, Paul and Johnny, that it is not only a likeable team, it is a really good team. I mean, I know they were only playing 10 men and last night for much of the second half, but even in the first half, they zip the ball about well, Johnny, and they play nice football, and there is this sort of ludicrous strength in depth where there are lots of players of sort of similar-ish ability that it's almost impossible to know. It's a very hard job for Gareth Southgate, I think.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about the amount of football that there is to be played between now and November. And I think most of us, if we had to pick a starting 11 for their opening group game, maybe only sort of two or three names would be properly nailed on. You know, you'd say Rice, maybe Kane, maybe Sterling. Everything else is, you know, some people would have Pickford, but everything else is kind of up in the air. You kind of need to start drilling some combinations. I think Southgate actually has maybe six or seven names that are nailed on in his mind. And you know, a few late bolters who could make the squad. But I think that strength and depth, while, you know, it's a huge asset, at some point you need to work out exactly how you're gonna line them up. Because I mean, before this game, Southgate did an interview and he was asked about the possibility of playing this Manchester City front three without, if Kane gets injured, whether you play Grealish and Sterling and Foden as a front three. And he just kind of batted the question away. He's like, well, it is an option, but I really want to see how Ollie Watkins does here. I want to see how Dominic Calvert-Lewin is. And it clearly hadn't entered his thinking at all, which I think shows that he has a lot clearer idea of how he wants this side to play than a lot of fans do.
If we move on from England, Wales drew 1-1 with the Czech Republic. Wayne Hennessy captained them, won his 100th cap. Gareth Bale described him as a rock in the squad. Northern Ireland lost 1-0 to Hungary. Ireland, Barry, you won again. When you wrote that article about the future of Ireland looking bright, were you picturing a 97th minute winner from Troy Parrott for a 1-0 win over Lithuania?
I'd kind of forgotten about the existence of Troy Parrott because he seems to have been around for years and constantly mentioned as this great up-and-coming striker without ever actually playing. I think he's at MK Dons now on loan from Spurs. Correct me if I'm wrong. He scored, lovely goal in the 7th minute of 5 minutes added time for a 1-0 win. And Ireland probably deserved to win, but they did struggle to break down a very poor Lithuania side. But yeah, it's a great win. And Irish fans are definitely reconnecting with the team they had very much fallen out of love with, I think.
5 goals in 34 for MK Dons this season, Troy Parrott. Bear says, the trouble with listening to Football Weekly as you go to bed is when Max says things like, back to the football, Barry, Ireland drew with Belgium, you think he's underselling possibly the biggest upset in football. It's important where you put the comma in that sentence. We should also mention, before we move on from football that happened in Europe, Christian Eriksen scoring. It was Denmark's third goal in their victory over Serbia. A sort of classic Eriksen cutting onto his right foot and then putting it into the bottom left-hand corner. The stadium in Copenhagen went completely wild, as it should. Lovely stuff. And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Portugal and Poland getting through. Barry discovering that Matt Cash plays for Poland. Not before time. And the qualifiers from Africa as well. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Some exciting news, Barry. We are producing some Football Weekly merchandise. Exciting ideas like a mug, a scarf, a David Squires-based poster of some sort. It's hard to know, Barry, what people would actually buy. I don't know what people would buy who listen to this podcast. But what we'd like is listeners to send us things that they would consider buying, and then we'll make them and sell them to you. So if you have an idea of something you'd like, a famous quote or a picture of someone, or I don't know, anything you like, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Is there anything that springs to mind, Barry? Do you think people would buy a T-shirt with your face on it?
I hope millions of people buy T-shirts with my face on them and I get loads and loads of money in image rights hosed into my bank account. That would be ideal.
Okay, that sounds like the spirit. Any profits we make, once we've obviously taken a massive cut, we'll go to sustaining The Guardian's excellent investigative journalism on important things. Send us your ideas, please. Portugal beat North Macedonia 2-0. Ronaldo said pretty much you can't have a World Cup without Portugal. Fernandes scored both goals. Are we happy that Portugal are at the World Cup, Johnny? Are you happy about that?
I think so. You know, it's certainly been a kind of a tough few years for them because they have this incredible squad, this incredibly, you know, stacked squad of attacking talent. And it feels like they're just about managing to work out how to use it all. I mean, obviously, you know, you have Cristiano Ronaldo and you have Bruno Fernandes, but then can you also play João Felix? And then can you play Bernardo Silva in the front three? Like, you know, like he would probably prefer to play.
Jota as well.
And Jota, exactly. I think Jota started through the centre and Ronaldo played on the left. And who played on the right? Vitrina? Otavio. It's Otavio. That's it. Anyway. He's the guy who provides the balance, because you can't play Ronaldo and Fernandes without having people around them who can actually press and hustle and run and fit into a structure. So I think there's a huge amount of potential in that side, and I think, you know, it would be good. It is good to see good players at the World Cup. I think it is a shame for North Macedonia. The first goal, I think, was a really bad error. Basically, just gave the ball to Fernandes, and they've had a really. I mean, it's not fair, really, because we're going to come to Poland, and Poland have basically had one home game against Sweden to qualify, whereas North Macedonia, who, let's not forget, won in Germany in their group phase, then had to go to Italy and win, and then had to go to Portugal and win. It doesn't really seem that fair. But they've done really well, and they will be back, I'm sure.
I mean, life isn't fair, I guess. That's the only thing I'd conclude from that. But yeah, you make a point. Poland are through. Johnny says, am I the only one who was really glad that Sweden failed to qualify just to stop the Zlatan story? Paul, your thoughts?
It's still not over. You can't fully put the Zlatan story to bed at this point. I mean, to be honest, the number of times I thought, finally, Zlatan is finished. And then he's, you know, at Milan, he's popping up and scoring all kinds of goals. So no, we shouldn't ever say it's finished. He could be there. Yeah, he could be there the next World Cup.
Somehow he'll find a way. Exciting news for you, Barry, to find out that Matty Cash is off to the World Cup.
Yes. I tuned into this game and was absolutely gobsmacked when I saw Matty Cash sending across.
How have you missed this bit?
Well, I famously missed... I've missed quite a lot of big news over the years. Most recently, Sergio Ramos has moved to PSG from Real Madrid.
Talk about funding the Guardian's groundbreaking investigative journalism. This is the kind of stuff we're talking about.
But I had no idea Matty Cash played for Poland. And then I did some cursory Googling and found a very interesting interview. Paul Doyle, who recently left the Guardian, best of luck to him, did with him in November, in which Matty Cash explained this great story. And there's probably no point in me telling the story because presumably everyone knows it. But it involves...
Well, tell us anyway, why not?
Matty Cash's maternal grandfather as a small child, along with his two sisters and his mum, was captured by Soviet troops in a Polish city, sent to a Siberian gulag where they were held for a couple of years. Then they were released by Stalin, following some sort of agreement between the Polish Prime Minister and the Soviet ambassador in London. They went to Iran, then India, then Tanganyika. And after 6 years in Africa, they got on a ship that rocked up in Liverpool docks. And Ryszard, who was Matty Cash's grandfather, he became an engineer, married a Polish girl. He met an Ealing called Janina. And their daughter, Barbara, is Matty Cash's mother. And Matty had approached not the current Polish manager, but the one before him, asking, you know, I'm eligible to play for Poland. Do you want me? And the guy said no, because he wasn't interested in getting the diaspora involved. But the current manager was very interested. So he got his passport late last year, set foot in Poland, I think, for the first time in November, and is now off to the World Cup. So yeah, very nice story. And I'm sorry I'm so far behind the curve on this one.
I think this is why people love you, Barry. Paul, it looked like you were going to come in on something. Were you not? I don't know.
No, I had nothing to say on that at all. No, no. I mean, a few months ago I did, but
yeah. let's look at the African qualifiers then. John says, would the panel still be able to podcast at their highest level if someone was shining a laser pen in their face? How many lasers is too many lasers, asked James. Reddish says, do you enjoy Laser Quest? I mean, so many lasers in Mo Salah's eyes as he steps up to take the penalty. I mean, actually, they were shining in his face as he was lining up for the anthems. I don't know if they followed him back for the entire match, but it is, Paul, ridiculous.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. And the sad part about it, I think, is nothing can be done now. So it's clearly going to have had an impact on that penalty. And, you know, I already felt sorry enough for the guy, you know, for them to lose again to Senegal on penalties, for Salah not to be at a World Cup at this point in his career. It's, you know, he's carried that Egypt team. So, yeah, it was a tremendously sad thing, I think, personally. And it's cast this shadow over the whole match and the whole qualification for Senegal. And obviously, no one in Senegal is going to care. The fans are not going to care. And there'll be no punishment that can do anything. Maybe there'll be a game behind closed doors here or there, but there is no punishment that now makes up for that. And it made me think what could have actually been done. And there really is nothing. If Salah had refused to take the penalty and got the team to walk off, they would have been banned. There would have been riots. It would have been absolute chaos. So really, we're in a situation where there was nothing to do. There's nothing to do about it. There's a victim. There's a beneficiary. And football is kind of powerless to do anything about. You know, there are security searches, but, you know, how effective are those? And so, yeah, it's a real tragedy, personally. The only one thing I will add, and this is not particularly relevant in that way, but Senegal did dominate throughout. And I think Egypt were clinging on, fairly lucky to get to penalties. But that doesn't obviously make it okay.
During the course of my extensive research for this pod, I ended up going down a sort of laser pen rabbit hole on the internet, because I was trying to figure out, do they actually impair your vision? Because it didn't look as if he was affected by them until he missed the penalty. And apparently it depends on the wattage of the pen.
Oh, right.
But I also found a YouTube video in which various American athletes, like baseball players, basketball players, American football players, were having lasers shone at them, and games were actually stopped, and officials went into the crowd and identified the culprits and had them removed. So there is...
They'd still be there now, Barry. There are about 500 of them.
Producer Joel suggests a Football Weekly branded laser pens, of course, with... of course, the adequate wattage to put off other live, you know, live show, podcast live shows, competitors. We'd put them off. I did think, considering they were at the anthems and they were 120 minutes, the battery life is good on a laser pen hawked by a man outside a stadium in Senegal. But anyway, sorry, Barry, you were in mid-flow.
No, I didn't really have much else to add, but just to say that several, you know, college football games, Major League Baseball games, basketball games have been stopped because players were complaining about, you know, I'm trying to take this three-pointer and someone's shining a light in my face. And so, yeah, the game has been paused while the culprits were found and ejected from the premises.
I suppose you could, Paul, erect some kind of sort of big sheet sort of from the goal. So like the player, it was just the player and the goal, like a cover goes over the goal and the player. If there were too many laser pens, that could be a solution.
We are going to try and pitch this to FIFA. Needless to say, yeah. It did also occur to me that you use laser surgery for eye problems, right? So if Salah had already had an eye problem, this would have been a massive own goal.
It may have corrected his vision now. He's got perfect vision.
Imagine how good he'll be now.
I just wanted to make the point that it's a real shame that these two sides, who, you know, are probably two of the best sides in Africa were facing each other at this stage. I mean, because they did the draw for these playoffs based on the world rankings, the FIFA world rankings in November, which is fine, obviously, you know, logistically that's probably makes sense. But the problem is you then had an AFCON in January and February, which changed the world rankings and quite significantly. So had they done the draw based on the current world rankings, Senegal and Egypt would both have been seeded and wouldn't have played each other, which is, you know, it's obviously, you know, you have to beat who you're up against. It's just kind of a shame that clearly these are two of the best seed times of the continent. And it's hard to argue, as with Europe, you have to say, that the best teams have made it out of qualifying from that continent.
Yeah, I mean, Nederman and Jonathan Wilson were making this point last week on the pod, Paul, that actually it isn't fair. We're talking about North Macedonia's journey compared to Poland's, and it doesn't seem right that this is how the African countries qualified.
No, but it won't be again, I imagine, now that we're going up to 48. And I think this is going to be the big question is, there's obviously a gain in that these teams will qualify and we'll have a much stronger set of teams. We won't have to agonise about losing the likes of Egypt at this stage. But obviously the downside is the drama that's removed from this qualification process and, you know, these moments that are incredibly dramatic and exciting. So, yeah.
I mean, there was that in the Algeria-Cameroon game. I mean, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? When Algeria scored in the 118th minute, they're going through and then Cameroon get through in the last kick of the game.
Yeah, and I think especially agonising, given, you know, it's an overused term, but it's something of a golden generation for Algeria and, you know, like to Mahrez and Slimani and the fact, you know, they had this goal ruled out by VAR in extra time. So first they thought they'd won it. Then they really thought they'd won it on 118. And to still concede on 120 plus four, I mean, it was actually pretty horrible to watch the players and what they were going through. It's absolutely brutal for Algeria.
No Nigeria at the World Cup. Ghana are through on away goals. It's a sort of fascinating rivalry between those two countries as well. Ghana came through and Morocco hammered DR Congo, although the Congo goal by Ben Malango, it's a bit like Adebayor for Arsenal against Spurs, you know, when he sort of chests it and then volleys on the turn, was absolutely brilliant. So Morocco through and Tunisia through as well. I don't know if you want to pick any of those out, Paul.
Actually, the thing that I wanted to mention about Morocco is that the coach might not make it to the World Cup again. He's absolutely hated now after this feud. You know, he's got two feuds now on the go. The squad seemed to really despise him. I think it started with Hakim Ziyech and him dropping him, and now Nasrouri also seems to hate him. The fans were booing him pre-kickoff. He didn't even come out during the warm-ups. And it would be amazing because I think I'm right in saying Khalid Ziyech has led taken four countries to qualify for the World Cup. But I think Japan sacked him after he qualified for the World Cup last time. I think there's a good chance Morocco will sack him before this World Cup.
God,
and that
rough,
is quite a record, isn't it? But he must be, I get the impression he's a tough man to work for anyway.
Chris says, how does Paul feel the Oceania qualifiers have gone? How will the winner do in the continental playoff? So here we are. You've been tweeting a lot about the sort of chaotic nature of Oceania's playoff.
Yeah, so obviously the big game today is the final. It's New Zealand and it's the Solomon Islands. And you'd back New Zealand. They won this game handsomely the last time they met in the last qualification process. But Solomon Islands have come a long way in 4 years. And actually, a lot of that's based on futsal. They're a brilliant futsal team, the best in the region. And players like Rafael Leao, who's their star, have come through this system. The way the Solomons play is actually very exciting. They're a very fast-paced team. And New Zealand have done well in qualification, but they've played against teams that have really had nothing to offer. Tahiti basically tried to rugby tackle them out of the game last time. New Zealand missed about 45 chances and eventually bundled one home. So it's going to be very tough to call today. I think New Zealand will win, but I think then Costa Rica is going to be a big challenge for them. As you say, the start of the competition, I won't go on about it for too long, but it was basically...
No, please do, because, you know, we don't hear about this and we repeat ourselves ad nauseum about most things that are happening in football, so I'm all ears.
Well, it's a COVID farce, basically, and the situation in Oceania is very difficult. There's been no football because of COVID since 2019, so they had to find a qualification process that worked. None of the nations in that region were able to host a tournament. New Zealand would have been the obvious choice, but because of COVID rules, some teams had to drop out entirely. American Samoa and Samoa can't travel due to COVID restrictions. So what OFC did was create this tournament in Doha, in Qatar. So you've got all these teams that are mostly Oceania-based travelling 10,000, 11,000 kilometres for this one-off tournament. Basically, the problem was COVID got into the camp. So COVID got into the Vanuatu camp. They travelled all the way to Qatar, tested positive for COVID before their first game. Most of the squad had it and had to forfeit the first game and then didn't get enough players back. So basically went home again. They didn't play a single game, Vanuatu. To make matters worse, the Cook Islands, who hadn't played a game for 6 years internationally, were in the same group. They played their first game against the Solomon Islands, lost 2-0, which was a brilliant effort, considering one of their players was in Step 9 in England. He plays in the Wimbledon and District League, one of the Cook Islands players. You know, it's a very, David Goliath situation. Only lost 2-0 to the Solomon Islands, but then they all tested positive for COVID, and they all had to go home too. So Group A became, that result had to be stricken from the record. So Group A became a two-team group with just one match. It was Tahiti against the Solomon Islands, both teams already through. Solomon's beat Tahiti, making Tahiti the only team, I think, in history with 0 points to go through their group. and it was all basically because of this COVID situation where the tournament being a 1 week long thing in, or, you know, 10 day thing in Doha, meant there was no backup. There were no dates they could use to mean teams could get players back operational after COVID. There was no chance of flying players back in. So while I think OFC had a very difficult job, it became this absolute farce, you know, leading to this stage. So I think everyone will hope tonight is a really good game, but it's been a very jarring and difficult process for a lot of the teams involved. I feel especially sorry for Vanuatu, you know, travelling all that way for your one crack at it and then having to fly back home.
When Paul said there about one of the Cook Islands players being in Step 9, I thought he meant Alcoholics Anonymous. He was going around making amends to everyone.
In the Asia group, so Iran, South Korea, Saudi Arabia and Japan are through. Saudi Arabia beat Australia 1-0. The crisis, Australian football, as I've said already before, and I know we have quite a few Australian listeners, is perennially in crisis, but it's in major crisis now. They're a little bit unlucky against Saudi Arabia from the highlights that I saw. But what is quite funny is that their manager is Graham Arnold, and people are quite rightly questioning his tactics because Australia have had a pretty poor qualification. They could still get through. They've got to play the UAE in a playoff. The winner of that game will play Peru in a playoff to get through. So it will be extraordinary if they do manage to get through to the World Cup now, if they win both those games. But Graham Arnold's best friend is Robbie Slater, who is almost like of a one-man mission to say it's nothing to do with Graham Arnold. And everyone else is saying, I think it's got something to do with Graham Arnold. And then Robbie Slater just writes columns going, this person doesn't know anything. Mark Bosnich doesn't know anything. And then another journalist, you're not very nice. And it's just quite fun to sit and watch, Blackburn Rovers or West Ham's Robbie Slater defending Graham Arnold until the last stage. So who knows? Once again, Graham Arnold may not be in charge. He may be in charge when Australia play the UAE. In South America, Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, Uruguay, all through. Peru will meet whoever they meet. CONCACAF, the USA, we talked about their win over Panama. They accidentally celebrated with a qualification banner, even though they're not actually qualified yet.
Mission accomplished.
If they lose by six or more to Costa Rica, it's unlikely it would send them into that playoff against New Zealand or the Solomon Islands. Although Christian Pulisic, our friend, did say, look, they were just handed something. They waved it about. They didn't know what they're doing. It doesn't mean that they're taking Costa Rica lightly. Paul, you tweeted about San Marino playing their first ever official game against a team from outside of Europe when they played Cape Verde. This is exciting.
Yeah, actually, I've got to say, and this is where my nerd credentials come through, San Marino are actually starting to make some progress. And I say it very gently. They got a new coach. Only lost 2-0 to Cape Verde, who are a very good team, Cape Verde, and lost 2-1 to Lithuania, who famously gave Republic of Ireland a bit of a battle. But better than that, their under-21s also, I think they just drew with Lithuania. I think there is just some tentative signs that San Marino may be making progress. But one of the great things is to see them playing non-European opposition, because one of the reasons their world rankings always so terribly low is they just played much better teams. If they could get out to play the Cook Islands with their players in Step 9, and if they could get out to play, you know, Solomon Islands, they may have a chance. Whereas they tend to play all their games against teams that are naturally much better.
Anyway, the draw is on Friday, isn't it? So look, we'll react to that. I could tell you who's in which pot, but you don't need to know who's in which pot now, because you'll lose the will to live if I just read out every team and what pot they might be in. You just find out what they're in, or just watch the draw, or just wait until the draw's done and we'll talk about it. And that'll do for part two. Will Unwin will join us in part three. He's chatted to the chief executive of Shakhtar Donetsk, and we'll find out how that club is coping under the Russian invasion. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's welcome the Guardian's Will Unwin. Hey, Will, how are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks. Thanks for coming on. You've spoken to Sergei Palkin, the chief executive of Shakhtar Donetsk. How was he?
I think stoic, I guess, is the word to use. He was, you know, very positive at the time. Considering the stressful situation, I was expecting a far more shortened interview and expecting him to probably not want to be, you know, too truthful, but he was. And it was, yeah, it was an interesting one to do. You know, luckily there was no sort of bombing in the background or anything like that, which I was slightly worried was going to happen for some reason. I don't know why. I'm not a war correspondent. Yeah, it was a very fascinating one to do. They were, you know, very keen to get their story out there, obviously. So there was an eagerness on their part. I can't claim I'm searched out this fine interview by myself. I was approached by Shakhtar. But yeah, it was an incredible one to do. And I've also spoken to their director of football, Dario Cerna, last week as well for something else. So I'm big in Ukraine at the moment. But yeah, you know, they've got many facets to their story, from not being able to let their players move on loan to the Premier League to what they're doing, you know, within Ukraine, from helping refugees to funding the armed forces at the moment. So there's a lot going on within Shakhtar, and having to, you know, decamp from Donetsk all those years ago via Lviv and Kharkiv and Kiev, and now back to Lviv to help with the humanitarian effort.
I mean that's a fascinating part that I'd kind of not necessarily forgotten or hadn't really taken notice of all those years ago, when I guess none of us really took as much notice of the Russians invading the Donbass region as much as we should have done, is that Shakhtar have been a sort of nomadic club for years now, haven't they?
Yeah, it's one of those where you see they're playing Real Madrid in the Champions League, like, they're playing it in Kiev. That's a bit odd. But yeah, no, they've left Donetsk in 2014, went to Lviv, so completely the other side of the country, then decided to go back east to Kharkiv and were there for a few years. And in 2020, moved, you know, everything to Kiev, players, training, club offices, and everyone went to Kiev in 2020.
What's the situation with, like, the players and the staff?
So the foreign players have all left. Day one of the invasion, all the players, the foreign players, were put into the club hotel with staff, and they got together and tried to work out plans to get the foreign players out. The foreigners are generally Brazilian. You have an Israeli who is Manuel Solomon, who I actually have interviewed in the past, and he just decided to go by himself and got to the Polish border by himself, where he's picked up by the Israelis. He's an Israeli international, and he just decided that it was better to go alone, whereas a lot of the players, the Brazilians, ended up going to Bucharest, which was interesting, and getting help from Alexander Čeferin to do so, and they went there, and they've then flown back to Brazil from Bucharest after spending a few days at the National Football Academy in Bucharest to be safe, which was, they went alongside the Dinamo Kiev players as well, who are managed by Mircea Lucescu. So that's the link with Romania and why they went there. But now one of the Brazilian players, who's the captain, Junior Moraes, has signed back in Brazil with Corinthians, whereas the other players find it quite hard, especially to move to Europe. You know, Bundesliga, Serie A, Premier League won't allow any of these players to move. So they're sort of stuck in Brazil doing personal training sessions and things like that. I spoke to a Championship employee yesterday. They tried to sign someone from Shakhtar, and they were told not to bother because they weren't, you know, bending the rules for stuff even in the Championship to bring players in.
So this is basically because the transfer window is closed.
So the transfer windows are closed. UEFA and FIFA say that these players are free agents. You can sign, you know, they're essentially free agents, so you can sign them outside of the official transfer window. But then the Premier League said, no, due to sporting integrity reasons, we won't let you sign any of these players. You know, they won't increase the squad sizes from 25. So then they're like, well, the only people that can sign them are people that have already got space in the squad. So then it's not the same for everyone. Like, so yeah, they're not very flexible in these things, which is quite a strange one at this stage.
Well, quite a few Shakhtar's Ukrainian players are now in Lviv, just helping out in a very hands-on way, distributing medicine, food, water to those who need it. Is that correct?
Yeah. So essentially, Shakhtar set up within the Lviv arena where they played a shelter for refugees, because obviously so many are going through Lviv to get to the Polish border, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands. It's, I think last week it was 3.7 million Ukrainians have left the country. So you can imagine how many are going through Lviv as a safe city, or supposedly safe city. So yeah, and the Shakhtar Ukrainian players, unlike the foreigners, aren't allowed to leave the country because they are of age to be in the army. But as the chief exec told me, I think they're last on the list because they've got no military training. So yeah, they're there helping, you know, they're packing boxes, speaking to people, you know, delivering bottles of water and food and supplies to those who need it in Lviv. I've always believed football is actually, you know, can be a very uniting thing. And whoever you support, it's probably quite reassuring to see someone that you can recognise doing their bit, you know, in it for a recognisable brand in Ukraine.
In very trying circumstances. I think, look, we've all been completely struck by the incredible resilience of the Ukrainian people. Is that the sense that you got from the people that you spoke to?
Yeah. Yes. It's a lot of unity. You know, I think if you read the piece, you know, we are united as one against a common enemy. There's probably a bit of swearing about Vladimir Putin that didn't make it into the piece. Unsurprising, you know, views are very strong. But yeah, they're a united nation. They believe they'll win. You know, the just general disgust, I think, is high. But it has, as I say, brought them together. If I was, you know, here, we don't see the impact of what's happening. I was in Bucharest for 2 weeks until last Saturday, and you walk around Bucharest and there's just Ukrainian cars parked everywhere of people that have driven over. And if you think the news is graphic here, the news in Romania is very graphic. And you can see that impact. And I think that sort of hit home to me more was here. You know, I'll see there's a few houses with flags on and some very nice gestures, but the actual on your doorstep in Bucharest of what's happening, which is why, you know, why I wanted to do the piece, you know, especially when you see that, it is, you know, there's a lot of Ukrainians in Romania trying to start a new life, and you recognise that. But those that are in the Ukraine are, yeah, their views are reinforced. They're not, you know, that everyone is doing what they can, from, you know, footballers to those that have signed up to the military, to those that have the money to provide humanitarian efforts, or to, you know, influence people to get more arms, influence to get arms via financial means. And yeah, as I say, I think at the start I said they were stoic and they went back down and they're fighting for what, you know, is right.
We've spoken a bit before when we've interviewed we interviewed a coach who's out in Ukraine, in Dnipro at the moment, about the symbolism of, you know, Ukrainian flags and all those kind of gestures. I wondered if the people you've spoken to felt that that meant anything, whether it had an importance.
The CEO, Palkin, was very appreciative that football is doing their bit, probably more appreciative of UEFA and FIFA trying to do practical things, you know, from stopping Russia playing and Russian teams playing. You know, he was very pleased over the Premier League and all of the leagues that have shown support with gestures before matches. Gestures only go so far. When it actually came to the crux of trying to let Ukrainian players at Ukrainian clubs sign in England, it was just they came up with reasons why it couldn't happen. So that's where the frustration is. And I think especially from people like Dario Cerna, and he was very critical of agents trying to take players for free and trying to make the most of the situation, which is a disgrace. If you're trying to create a stereotype of a group of people, the agents not coming out of it great. So yeah, there's a lot of frustration that when you've got so many things going on, and one of the things you're trying to do is move players, but at the same time stop people taking advantage of moving players, and which is laughable. So yeah, it was just a desperation for proper action rather than seeing flags. And yeah, you know, all money raised is very welcome, but if you're gonna back something and you know back it with everything you can, don't come with excuses to say why you don't want something to happen.
Oh well, thanks so much for doing it, Will. Appreciate your time. Before you go, and this is a huge gear change, but like I make no apology for ridiculous gear changes. It's important we talk about Ukraine and what's going on. But you did send into the WhatsApp group some fantastic pub graffiti, which is obviously completely unrelated to this, which said what?
Dean Marnie, originally, and then someone had updated it with Blackburn Legend in a biro, which was upsetting after the permanent marker Dean Marnie.
Oh, that's great. It was just normal handwriting Dean Marnie, was it? Where was it?
Block Capitals in a Manchester pub, the City Arms, which is a fine pub. Last night, as I sat there not watching the football but still booing Harry Maguire, another Hull City legend like Dean Marnie. So yeah, no, Dean's big in inner city Manchester pubs.
What was this like on a toilet door, Will?
It was above the urinal. If you want to picture it, Baz, it was above the urinal. I'd done my business, and then I thought I'd better take a photo, otherwise I'll regret it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Do you think it's just Dean Marnie just signs the toilet?
Maybe. Maybe if you do a pub crawl in Manchester, it's just Dean Marnie and every urinal going.
You're up there presupposing, Paul, that Dean Marnie signs his autograph in block, his signature in block capitals. It's not a joined up one. I think most, even at Dean Marnie level, you know, when he was really knocking, you know, when he was really sort of bossing it for Hull City, he'd have learnt a quick, like, you know, he's got to get through those Dean Marnie ones. And if anyone else has some high quality pub graffiti they'd like to share with us, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Thanks, Will. Cheers, mate.
Cheers off to the graffiti in my toilet.
Good man. Will Unwin there. Let's move on to a quite bizarre story of Staines Town. I'm not entirely sure how much we can talk about it, but it's an extraordinary statement if you haven't seen it. I would encourage everyone to seek it out in full. Some select quotes from the statement. Staines Town Football Club regrets to announce that pursuant to third-party breaches of Section 54 of the Modern Slavery Act, 2015, and other information that's come to light, we're forced to temporarily suspend all primary operations, including but not limited to competitive fixtures, until a thorough investigation into the practices of Downing LLP has been concluded by the relevant authorities. Of particular interest to those involved at all levels of football, both within the UK and globally, it's come to our attention through both substantive and vast evidence from various sources that Downing LLP, who control and fund the operation of our landlord, the Thames Club, may be involved through its other holdings in financing of large-scale bribery and corruption. Elsewhere, we have also been provided with vast amounts of evidence that Downing LLP may be involved through its other holdings in the financing of environmental crimes, price fixing, deforestation, forced evictions, human rights abuses, child labour, slavery, gender discrimination, and murder. Downing LLP said the allegations were untrue and an attempt to deflect attention away from financial mismanagement of the club. It said the allegation that Downing had breached any Russian sanctions legislation was also wholly untrue and baseless. Kelly Discipline, CEO of the Isthmian League, said she was only aware of the information being shared on social media. She said, "We're in contact with the FA. We have a board meeting tomorrow. We've contacted the club, but haven't had a response yet."
The innocence of non-league football, you know, it's a purer and you know, it's a purer world, isn't it? You know, you go and follow your local team, and you know, there's none of this kind of none of this ugliness that you get with the, you know, the Premier League and big football. It's you know, it's unspoiled. It's an unspoiled world. I don't know what we can say about it, really.
What we can say is an excellent name for a CEO of a league, having the surname Discipline.
Debbie Discipline.
Kelly Discipline. It's not Debbie. Debbie Discipline would be... Debbie Discipline is definitely in a film that, you know, that if you have certain interests, I imagine, oh no, it's Debbie Discipline. But anyway, should probably move on. Not necessarily ended that story how we perhaps should have done. Doncaster Rovers, this is brilliant. A fan, Jimmy DRFC, tweeted out, "A goalless march, so let's vote for our favourite shot instead." So he's done, I think it's 8 shots. He's got Life of Riley by the Lightning Seeds, and it's just 8 shots by Doncaster Rovers players, the first of which goes about 25 yards wide. It almost goes out for a throw-in. It's really, really good. I enjoyed that tremendously. And it did remind me of the Doncaster Rovers official YouTube channel doing highlights of their goalless draw with Fleetwood Town in 2015.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Doing the players walking out, the whistle, the game beginning, it then cutting to a goal kick and the game ending and nothing else at all. So thank you to the people of Doncaster for entertaining us, both the official channels and the unofficial ones. Finally, this is from Ian, who says, as an Ian myself, I'm relieved to hear that Mini Rushton is not, after all, called Ian. Ian is possibly the dullest name alongside Keith. I don't think I've ever met a younger one than I am, 40. Can you imagine calling a tiny baby Ian? Of course not. Love to you both and Ian. Thanks, Ian. Appreciate it. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Paul.
Paul?
Sorry. My internet just dropped out. Sorry, I'm not ungrateful. Thank you.
It's just like you just didn't want to say goodbye. You just leave it hanging there. Anyway, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
That's all right. Thank you, Johnny.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back tomorrow. Our producer is Joel Grove and our executive producer is Christian Bell.
This is The Guardian.